Welcome to Lead to Succeed. This is the podcast to hear from the leaders of today in various fields, from entrepreneurs to corporate directors.
We hear their stories, lessons learned and challenges faced, as well as insights and advice to become a successful and an inspiring leader.
The podcast is presented by us,
Callum
and Rebecca Jenkins, as we both believe that we all have the potential to be outstanding leaders if that's what we choose. So, a very, very big welcome to Cherie Concannon. Cherie is the founder of RPO Manufacturing, and it's going to be amazing to have her on this podcast today because she has so much experience, not only in running her own business, which is raising performance in operations, but also in working with leaders. And we're going to get insights from both angles, I think, today, which is going to make it a great podcast indeed.
Super.
So Cherie, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Looking forward to it.
Fantastic. So I'm going to kick off and just ask you and get your perspective on what you think the difference is between being a manager and a leader.
Yeah. Okay. Great question. I love this question. I try and distill it to a very succinct answer. And that is that I believe managers can be appointed to their role, but a leader can only be elected. So that's my answer in a nutshell, because, you know, if you're appointed to a role, it does not mean to say that the people you are managing have any feeling about appointing you as their leader. So leadership has to be earned. I think that's the primary difference. And I think that if people are appointed as managers, you can't just assume that the people within your team will see you as their leader. So yeah, that would be my answer.
And just on that point, Cherie, do you mean you think your team has to accept you as a leader then? They have to?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I think with the appointment of authority or the designation of authority does not come in any way the allegiance or following or loyalty of the people that you have been appointed to manage. So I think leadership stands alone, and you see leadership in all sorts of situations. You see it in a playground, in a school, you see it in sporting teams, and you see it in the working environment. You know, we must have all seen teams where the appointed manager is not respected in any way, shape or form, and the actual leader of that team is a member of the team. I work in factories, in manufacturing, and that's my RPO is all about identifying hidden leadership, the true leadership that exists on a shop floor, because invariably it is not the team leaders, it is not the shift manager, it's not the manufacturing supervisor, it's not the production supervisor. Inevitably, it is someone on the shop floor. And you know, quite often it could be a union representative or a union convener, and that's where we get difficulties in manufacturing.
Okay, that's a really interesting point. That's quite different to what I think most kind of textbooks have written down, isn't it? A leader is someone that's kind of bought into, has an initial vision to get things going, and then once you've kind of gone past that that sort of phase, you want to have someone to come in and manage and have things tick over.
Yeah.
What you associate with them.
Yeah.
Managerial.
Yeah. Well, isn't it? Yeah. Okay. Yes. Yeah. I have a very different view. My RPO is something very, very different. It's not a top down approach. It's a bottom up approach. The whole purpose of it is to increase the efficiency and productivity level of what I call human assets, the human beings within a manufacturing site. And within a manufacturing site, although we've got huge automation these days, people are still in charge. We still need the human beings. And we need the human beings in manufacturing to actually do the jobs, to actually make things, to actually operate the machines. And what happens in manufacturing is they spend a huge amount of money employing people in senior leadership roles to create lean processes, introduce new equipment, focus entirely on new ways of working. And then the idea is we communicate that down to the workers, to the shop floor, to the operators, because we know best. And I think that is, I was going to use a word that we can't use it. I think it's a load of codswallop. There you go. There's a better word. Because the leaders on a shop floor are amongst the operators. They are amongst the production staff.
Yeah.
They know how to operate the machines. They have ideas for improvement, but they're never consulted. And my approach is, find the natural leadership. I'm a big believer in natural leadership. Find the natural leadership and then teach them management skills, because you can learn management skills, but you can't learn leadership.
Yeah, sure. No, I think that's a really good point. And I was doing a bit of research about like kind of your past, like sort of career and what you've been doing, Sheree.
Yeah.
And obviously you've sort of been the founder of a couple of different companies, and you've been a success and these sorts of things. So I was going to ask you a question. Do you think there's ever been a time when you've sort of transitioned from like a managerial kind of role to more of a leadership role?
It
seems like you've probably been more of a leader most of the time than a manager, would you say?
Yeah, I was born and raised on a sheep farm in Western Australia.
Okay.
So out in the middle of nowhere. I am the eldest of four children.
Right.
And very interesting environment. Not many females, mostly guys. And I think I came out of the womb like this. So, and also the other thing that I would distinguish, Callum, is I don't think leaders necessarily make very good managers. In fact, most of the leaders I work with are particularly poor managers. They are they're quirky. I find all of them very quirky. I mean that affectionately, because I've got lots of them that I work with. Very strong in different ways, very authentic and very different. But the one thing that most of them have in common is they're actually very poor managers. Their ability to manage process and procedures is generally poor. And that is because I think they're required to inspire. So I am a poor manager. So by default, I think I fall more into the leadership category. You know, I recognize good managers, because that in itself is a real skill. So I recognize that. So sure. No, you answered it for me, Callum. I think I was born like this.
Sure, no, that makes sense. I thought you were going to probably say something kind of along those lines. yeah. That kind of like leads me into my next question. So being the founder of a couple of different companies and being a coach and these kind of things, has there ever been like a really, have you ever had like a problem that you've kind of come across that you felt like just felt almost sort of insurmountable, but inevitably in kind of how you dealt with that and that sort of thing?
Yeah, it's interesting. I was thinking about that question in preparation for this, and I had an issue with the word insurmountable.
Sure.
Because fundamentally, I don't believe that anything is insurmountable.
Yeah,
one of my core values is there is always a way or you die. I know that sounds harsh, but unless you die, there is always a way. So nothing is insurmountable. It might not necessarily turn out exactly as you want it to be. I think the nearest answer I can find to your question was, and it's relevant now because it was the last recession. I'm the person in my community, you know, which would include personal and professional. I'm the rock. You know, I'm the one that in a crisis, I'm the one that holds everybody together. So if I find anything insurmountable, that's not good. If you were to ask me to think of something I could find insurmountable, this is going to sound harsh, but getting over the loss of one of my children, if I had to, that might be. I might feel that would be insurmountable at the time, but I, thank goodness, have not had to deal with that. And I've seen and met other people who have, and have recovered from it, so even that is insurmountable.
Yeah, no, that'd be such a horrific thing. Definitely.
Oh yeah.
Fortunately, you haven't. But perhaps in the like in a professional sense, is there? Have you ever come across a time when you initially looked at something and thought, "Crikey, I don't know how I'm going to deal with that."
That happens.
And you managed to kind of get around it.
Yeah, that happens a lot, and then it's a case of walking away from it. And coming back to it, you have to take yourself away from it. So I can think of a couple of examples.
Sure.
I've had a couple of factories that I've been into, and I've started my RPO. Now, RPO is 10 years in the making. it's a complex beast, but it has dramatic improvement factors to it, generally within 12 months. Quite often, though, I will either meet a character. I remember one factory I went into, they had 16 team leaders in there, of which 8 were union representatives. And of the 8, they had in excess of 210 years of service between them.
Right, okay.
Now, when I we couldn't do anything, we could, they just locked everything down totally. And I looked at that and I thought, all right, okay, I cannot think. I mean, they were blocking everything we did every which way. They had complete control of the shop floor. And this was some time ago, it was about 10 years ago, total control. And I thought, if I go into a room with these guys, I'm dead meat. And I walked away from it. I came back and I thought, right, divide and conquer. All I've got to do is win over the right ones out of the 8. Sure. So I remember this guy, Irish guy, would have been late 50s. This is what I talk about, hidden talent. I got into a meeting with him, sat down. He was the leader of the 8. And I thought, right, this is the guy I've got to win over. I've absolutely got to get him on board. And we got talking. We were in there 2 hours. Do you know that guy was a master practitioner in neuro-linguistic programming?
Wow.
That's what he did outside of work. He was an Irish guy, had come over from Ireland. As he described it, for the first years of his career, he dug holes. That's basically what he did. And the reason why he'd gone so far in the union was because his talent had never been, as a leader, had never been recognized. He'd never been able to use, he had no education. He had a very, very strong accent. He had a shaven head. I mean, so he looked like a bare knuckle fighter, actually, to be honest. And he'd never been recognized. And he said he'd tried to find a way through the management routes, but had come up against a ceiling all the way through. So his only route to development was through the union. So he joined the union, he'd had all this training through the union, he'd got interested in NLP through the union, and he trained all the way up to master practitioner, and he did coaching outside of work. What an opportunity. So in work, he was their biggest disruptor, and he saw it as his mission to fight against the bureaucracy that had blocked him from flourishing as a natural leader. It could so much have been different. So what seemed insurmountable with these union reps, actually, hey, we got there after that. That factory is one of the first that I did an RPO in. And here's another one. The plant manager from that factory took early retirement a few years ago and is part of my RPO team now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So if he listens to this, he'll know who I'm talking about.
I think there's so many messages in that story, Sri. And one of them for me, interesting to get your perspective on this, is here was somebody with a huge amount of talent and skill, but the leadership team didn't recognise that because they hadn't got to know him as an individual.
Yep, yep. This particularly happens in factories, in manufacturing. You know, And it is because, and I don't know where this comes from, and this, I've got manufacturing sites in North America, in Europe, and in the UK, and it happens across all of them. Somewhere, there grows this assumption that if you are working on an assembly line or as an operator, basically on a shop floor, somewhere there grows this assumption that you either can't do anything else, don't want to do anything else, don't have the ability to do anything else. And then what happens is a culture develops, and us and them culture develops. So there's us, one side of the wall, and there's them, the other side of the wall. And do you know what the interesting thing is? The us, which I'll call the management, which is often what they call them, the management. Sorry about my little, you know. They develop what can only be described as, I would go as far as to say, a fear. you know, a nervousness about truly engaging with the people the other side of the wall. And then the people the other side of the wall can feel that. I did a project with a big brewery, big national brewery years ago. And they, this was actually about 15 years ago, and they asked me, they said, we want some ambassador training. I had no idea what ambassador training was. It turned out to be customer care training with our draymen. They were called draymen because there were no dray women. So I said, okay, what did draymen do? And this was some time ago, so forgive my terminology. They said, well, fundamentally, they deliver beer.
Yeah.
Okay. So, right. Okay. And they had literally hundreds of draymen. So there were two draymen to a lorry, and they would go out, they would go to pubs and they would deliver beer, but they would engage with the publicans and with customers, and they wanted to give them some customer service because apparently their customer service was, or their professionalism, they reckoned was a bit lacking. I said, yeah, great, cool. They said, well, we've got to warn you, we've already attempted this. We got a trainer in and we put them all together. We had them all together in a group. Unfortunately, he walked in, he had a great big bag and he started asking them questions. And then when they got it right, he threw them a Mars bar. Yes. Okay. So, unfortunately though, the drayman got vengeance. The next day, whilst he was delivering his program, a couple of them sneaked out and locked two pigeons in his very flashy BMW for 3 hours. I can't, the mind boggles, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So of course that relationship was set up, and they said to me, we now need someone else to do this. I said, yeah, absolutely no problem. Do you know what? They offered me a bodyguard.
Incredible.
They offered me a bodyguard to accompany me into the sessions. And I said, no. And I can remember this was down in Acton in London. And I remember I did one-to-ones. One-to-one is the key in this situation.
Yeah.
You get people in a group, very, very different to one-to-one. So again, the what I would have identified as the natural leader, again, guy, probably mid-50s, really big man mountain, very impressive human being. Sat down with him, got talking to him, and he, 2 hours it took him to just basically tell me what the problem was. You know, even to little things like at Christmas, the office has a buffet, and when they finish with the buffet, they put the scraps downstairs in the warehouse for the warehouse staff.
Sure.
You know, he noticed the biscuits because I'd asked for biscuits. He said, I've seen the biscuits that they have for the manager's meetings. They are chocolate covered, gorgeous biscuits. What have we got? Rich tea and digestive. Yeah. And you know, he went through this. Now, he was literally physically a very imposing man. But this is, this resonates with me and rings in my ears. At the end of that meeting, he said, look, he says, I can sum it up in one sentence. We just want to be loved.
Mm.
And I just thought, you know, there you go.
I think from that, Sheree, you could probably put that into kind of three pieces of advice for managers. I'm sure one of them is going to be around communication. But
yep.
But what would you give the managers and who want to be the leaders of the future to stop situations like that? What would you
okay.
really give them as three key pieces of advice?
Right. Every single one of them needs to study emotional intelligence. Understand, that would be my first piece of advice. Out of that, I think they need to develop supreme self-awareness and an understanding of their own strengths and weaknesses. And from that, they need to understand the impact that they have on other human beings. And then you are absolutely right. Communicate. I call it connect and engage. So it goes a bit further than communicating because people think they've sent emails and they've communicated.
Yeah.
So I prefer to use the word connect. So you need to have a way of connecting, but you need to have a way of checking that you have engaged. And this is probably going on to four. The biggie is every single human being is equal. power. Forget the concept of power imbalance kills productivity and efficiency. It kills everything. And we have these horrible management layers. I'm into self-directed, linear, working, empowered teams. You know, for me, I'd have no power hierarchy at all in anything. You know, it's hard to get away with it. But what we tend to do as human beings, particularly in business, is we put these layers in. And then when the people who are at the bottom of the layers aren't doing what we want them to, we stick some more layers in. And that kills communication. The more layers you put in, the more squashed they get, the more suppressed they get. Take all those layers out, lift everybody up in the whole community. So I'm very community-based. So I'm very much, actually, if I'm being really honest, I hate the word manager. I would not have any managers. I would just have leaders. And that's what we do in the factories. We have team leaders. And they are educated in emotional intelligence, self-awareness, connecting, engagement, as well as all the lean manufacturing processes they have to learn and all of that side of it. We give them that as well. But primarily, it's about people engagement. And I would have everything community-based with natural leaders leading so that the community chooses to follow.
Sure.
That's a really interesting perspective about not having any managers and having team leaders. Mm. What would you say makes for successful engagement and connection then, Sheree? If you could distill that down into
Involvement, empowerment, and actually enabling people to make the decisions that are going to affect them. So if I work in this team, I am able to make decisions, contribute to decisions, feel that I am have influence on my sphere in my working environment. So I see a leadership role. Leaders inspire, I think. Leaders are leaders. People follow leaders. So you always know you're the leader. The problem is that when people follow you, it gives you power over them. So leaders have to be responsible for that, and they have to nurture it and use it wisely. And a good leader gives that power to his or her people. So I find, and do you know, this is such a difficult thing to do. There are so few people that can do it. You know, I've been watching, I absolutely love Jacinda Ardern, the New Zealand Prime Minister. Mm-hmm. And that is because half of my team is in New Zealand. So the technical creative part of my team operates in New Zealand. So I go there quite a lot. And I've watched her during that horrible terrorist attack they had to deal with. I understand about the New Zealand culture, and I've watched her during the COVID-19 situation, and she would be the type of leader that I would describe. I can see her doing. I don't know her personally, but from what I've seen, I follow her on Facebook and I listen to her live, so you know. But I think she is an example of what I'm talking about, and I just hope no one bursts my bubble on that and she turns out to be that person.
Sure. I think that was really interesting what you said. I think it's very easy, isn't it, for someone who's kind of admired by people to kind of almost like let that go to their head a little bit. And we were sort of discussing this earlier on, that it's kind of having the confidence to be able to lead people, but not letting that border over into being kind of overly confident or sort of arrogant. Yeah. And I think that's a very fine line to get right and kind of also get it wrong.
Absolutely. Ego management, I call that, Callum.
Yeah, exactly.
You have to have, that would be another thing, you have to have control of your ego, which is incredibly difficult to do if you find yourself elevated to that position.
Yeah, most definitely. So do you think, Sheree, then, you would say, like, if you were working with these factories and stuff and they were looking to promote someone from kind of from a standard role up to being more of a leader, someone that inspires other people and sort of like influences their team, would you say that would be like the main thing that you would look for in someone?
Yeah, what we do within, when we go in and do an RPO, traditionally what we do, or typically what we do, is we take out all of the layers of production management, and then we introduce a team leader, RPO team leader role, and it has a huge incentive to it. It's a 24-month development program. There's no pay increase for this. People have to apply for this role and receive no pay increase initially.
Right.
All right. What we do is we have a very lovely carrot that we dangle, which is where they can be after 24 months. Then we have milestones at 6, 12, and 18 months. They have to hit the efficiency KPIs that impact on the bottom line, so they buy their own pay rises. And what typically happens, let's say we recruit a team of 8, one could be on a lower wage and one could be on a higher wage. They equal out as we go through the program, such that when we get to the end of it, they are all on exactly the same pay, and it's considerably more than the top earner was getting at the beginning. They operate as a self-directed team, so there is no leader in that team, and they report directly all the way up to the top. So there's no layers of management between then and the top, and they operate as a team. They have a coach, which is me.
Sure.
We give them massive education through the 24 months, but they run the shop floor as a self-directed team. It's very, very different. I have some stunning impact. Now, how do I choose them, which is your question? So we get applications. We open it to the entire production staff. Anybody can apply. It's a robust recruitment process, but fundamentally it's my decision. And that decision is intuitive, sure. Really. I watch them. We give them several exercises and a big lengthy interview, but I watch them and I spot it. And I've got one example with a factory down in East London, where we took a team of 8. Two of them had production experience, were in manufacturing. The other 6 came from stores. They had no manufacturing experience whatsoever, but they just were natural leaders.
Sure.
We put them together, and then it's like any kind of sporting team. It's getting them to be a high performance team. Every single problem they have to resolve together. And if one area is failing in that factory, the whole team's failing. They are responsible for. We have all sorts of things that we use to map their progress. We have a thing called, I use bowling charts for them to be able to map the impact they're making. So they have to identify process improvements, cost reductions, and they have to be able to define a monetary value on that that actually impacts on the bottom line. So they have to be trained in the commercial aspects of their business, and that they receive that training at the beginning. But yeah, it's an intuitive thing. You can spot it. You know, you've only got to watch people and you can pick the natural leaders out, but then they have to have the right attitude, because we can all name some leaders in history that have not been very nice people. We don't want any of them.
Yeah, no, exactly. I think that's a very interesting point you said at the start when you answered that, when you kind of get to that situation at the end where it's, everyone works together and there's no kind of single point of leadership. That's got to be so much more empowering and actually probably much more efficient than kind of the traditional kind of model you would have in manufacturing, I would imagine.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a hard message to get across, Callum, because, you know, our history is steeped in power hierarchies, you know, and human beings, some of them like to have power.
Yeah.
You know, and hierarchy has been our traditional way of doing things forever. You know, you're considered to be a bit of a hippie if you're into community things, but it absolutely works. So if you take my very hippie concept and you apply it to manufacturing, whoa, productivity and efficiencies go through the roof. Who'd have thought? You know, it's interesting. Yeah.
We've got a few more questions, I think, Cherie, if you don't mind.
No, you go for it.
You said you spot it. I get that, but could you explain what spot it is for our audience? Our audience are managers.
Yep.
You're thinking, oh my goodness, she's not keen on managers. So what is that spot it? Right. So they can help those users. What is it?
Yep. So a manager, I'm not keen on managers because I find generally that managers suppress. But a really good manager, I think, is good at defining efficient process and efficient procedures and communicating. So there is a role definitely to be played there. In terms of leadership, which I think is different, your question is asking me, how do I spot the leadership? For me, and it's my type of leader, because there are different types of leader, leaders you, when you talk to them and you engage with them and you ask them questions, are generally concerned about other people. Now, I don't mean from a perspective of caring. I mean from a perspective of feeling a responsibility for, desiring a responsibility for, being concerned about, and also they can come up with ways of enabling others to perform. And you can talk to someone and hear that about them. So I think people will follow someone because, number one, that person makes them feel safe. You know, you won't follow someone who is not going to make you feel safe. Mm-hmm. Secondly, that person has the ability to inspire, enthuse, or you actually believe that person's going to take you to the place that you want to go. So therefore, you might admire them. But generally for me, a good leader is primarily someone who makes people feel safe and empowers and enables. They would be the three things. Now, to empower and enable someone, you've got to be someone special, because you can't empower and enable unless you already feel empowered and enabled yourself. That's the key. So if we look at, let's say, your locus of control. So I have a very strong internal locus of control, which fundamentally doesn't make me a control freak. For me, it means I like to be able to influence my world, my bubble. So if we look at my bubble, I am comfortable when I have control in my bubble. You don't want to know me when I feel I haven't got any control in my own bubble. So for me, leadership would be about enabling someone else to feel that they have control in their bubble, and then wanting them to succeed. So when I interview and I'm looking for leaders, they are people that recognize that their success is not through them. Their success is through the people they're leading. And without the people they're leading, they are not a leader, because you can't be a leader all on your own. And without the people they're leading being successful, they're an unsuccessful leader. Yeah, you can only be a leader if people are following you.
Yes, I love that, Sheree, and I agree with you completely. You can't be that leader and give to others and support others unless you feel empowered to do so, and unless you feel you're able to do so, and that's part of who you are as an individual.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So I really resonate, and you put that together and explained that really well. Thank you.
I love talking about it. I love articulating the views on it, but just because I see it done so badly so often,
which is incredible when there is so much education out there about being a leader that goes to serve their team. There are so many.
I don't think people truly understand it though, Rebecca. I don't think they really get it.
No, probably not. And this is what this podcast is, to help people really understand what being a true leader is about. And also sharing vulnerabilities, isn't it? You haven't got to know the answer to everything.
No, it was one of the things that again is key. Authenticity. Yeah. Is absolutely key. I think if you're a genuine, true leader, people will follow you, but they need to also understand the good bits and the bad bits.
Yeah.
If a person can't see the balance between the good bits and the bad bits, how can they make a decision to follow you? Yeah. So I think it's not that you have to go around showing all your bad bits, but I think what you need to be, and I think this is where some of the training, leadership training goes wrong. We have so much focus on controlling your weaknesses and optimizing your strengths. Well, let's face it, most of us don't manage to control our weaknesses. We can't get rid of them. They're part of us. And I really believe that if you look and focus at your strengths, virtually all of your weaknesses are excesses of your strengths. You know? So if you have a weakness, so for me, impatience might be one of them. Well, I just call that an excess of passion. You know, I want something to happen. And yeah, you know, the passion
is that. Yeah.
But I look at all of my weaknesses, and I can track them back to a strength. So what I've got to control is the excess of the strength. And then I minimize the impact of the weakness. But you have to let people see. They have to understand, because it's a choice. Following is a choice for everybody. It's the one thing they can choose. And they have to be able to see all of your little foibles to make that choice.
I think that's a really valid point. I think it was interesting what you said, right? Enabling people kind of goes back to what we were saying before, wasn't it? About like developing that influence and that kind of culture and sort of inspiring other people around you, that makes you that kind of point that people kind of look up to and want to follow,
rather than
kind of being appointed to it because you've been told that you're on the manager or whatever.
Exactly.
It ties in, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
It has been truly wonderful to get your insights. Thank you. I've really loved it.
So have I. Thanks, guys, for inviting me.
Fabulous. Maybe we should just round up with one last question. For you to just share with us, what has been your most successful leadership? I'm not asking that question very well. What has been your example of where all this came together so well for you and you achieved something that you're most proud of as a leader?
Interestingly, it would be my RPO teams. I have three different businesses. One is a membership for small businesses. I also have private clients where I work alongside leaders, but my RPO is my big focus. And it would be some of my RPO teams, because fundamentally, although I call myself the coach of those teams, really I'm the captain. I got one team in America that I am particularly proud of in a factory in Minnesota. And there's only five of them. I've only been working with these guys for a year. They're strong characters. All five of them are strong. I pick them all. All five of them are strong characters. And that is, I'm very, very, very proud of them. You know, we're going through COVID-19 at the moment. They have a lot of challenges. They've remained working all the way through this. So they've got, you know, and it's a hardcore factory environment. You know, we're talking welding and we're talking heavy metal. Okay. So they're all having to wear the masks. We're having to socially distance. They're having to manage that, and also very tough manufacturing site in terms of what we needed to do in the turnaround. And our turnaround in the 12 months has been phenomenal. And they are, I do this, I meet with them half an hour every week, obviously video conference, mm-hmm. meet with them half an hour every week. They are just amazing. Whenever anything goes wrong in that team, I go back to my way of working, which is divide and conquer, meet with them individually. So most of the time it's a group meeting. Whenever anything's one of them straying a little bit, it's a one-to-one. But they would be my best example. Can I say the name of the factory? Is that okay? Can I give the correct name? Yeah. They're part of the Bueller Group. And they're based in Minneapolis in Minnesota. So big shout out to our Bueller Warriors. We give them all a name, you see, and they choose their name. So Bueller Warriors, Bueller Minnesota, Bueller Minneapolis, they rule. They're great.
Fantastic shout out for them. Sounds brilliant what they're achieving.
Yeah, they're great.
Really wonderful.
Yeah, that's amazing, yeah.
Yeah.
Super. I've loved this. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, people can connect with you on LinkedIn, and you do these amazing videos on a regular basis. So people can connect with you there.
Yep.
And it's been a real pleasure to have you on our podcast. Thank you so much.
I think it's been really amazing. I think you come across as a really passionate individual. You clearly know what you're talking about. And I think the points you raised have been like really... It's been such an interesting take to have someone like yourself kind of talk about like the manufacturing side of things, which I think is typically more like a male-dominated thing, and it's like quite a hierarchical thing.
Yeah.
And you sort of said early on about kind of coming at it from like a community sort of basis.
Absolutely.
I think a really interesting take on it. So yeah, no, thank you very much.
No, that's great, Callum. Thank you so much, guys. Fabulous.
Thank you, Cherie.
Cheers.